A message. This film has been modified from its original version. In a logo, a snow-covered mountain stands majestically against a pink horizon. A row of white stars soar toward the mountain and form an arch above its peak. Words appear. Paramount, a Viacom company. Now, a lighthouse sits against a gray sky and ocean. As its bright light turns, it sends off a brilliant flash. Titles appear. Paramount Pictures presents a Leonard Goldberg production. Now, orange clouds hang over the sun as it sits on the horizon. Rays of sunlight filter through the slats of a crooked beach fence. Now, golden sunlight glitters on the rippling ocean. Elsewhere, a person glides along the calm water paddling a kayak. More titles. Tommy Lee Jones as Travis Lehman. Ashley Judd as Libby Parsons. Double Jeopardy. This program has been described by the Media Access Group at WGBH with funding from CBS. Described by Nikki Zada, Carrie Donaghy, and Dutch Priest. Read by Pat Lentz. For more about description, call DVS at 1-800-333-1203. Now, in front of a large house surrounded by pine trees, a short-haired brunette sits with a four-year-old boy. Perched on rocks overlooking the ocean, they wind a fishing reel together.
Slowly.
I'm doing it slowly.
Okay, you got it. Oh, Maddie, look.
She gazes at the ocean.
See that? See that big boat out there?
Mm-hmm.
She is the prettiest boat on Whidbey Island. It's the Morning Star. Someday when you're big enough, I'm going to teach you how to sail. It's the best thing there is, sailing.
Sailing and fishing?
Yep.
More titles. Bruce Greenwood is Nick Parsons. Annabeth Gish is Angie. Now on the house's wooden deck, dozens of well-dressed people mingle. Inside, a bearded man holds a skewered shrimp. As cocktail sauce drips from the hors d'oeuvre, he glances around the room. Elsewhere, two men talk.
Nick, we need to talk.
Always happy to talk to you, Rudy.
Hey, Warren.
Huh?
You hear that notice from First Seattle today?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's it.
Good.
Then you know, we've got a real problem.
First Seattle is not a problem, Rudy. Martinis are a problem.
You mind?
Not at all.
Where were we? All right, First Seattle.
Now outside, a tall brunette holds Maddie.
Tommy. Hey, kiddo.
Hey.
How's it going?
A handoff.
Maddie's mom, Libby, takes him.
Oh, a sack of potatoes. Have you been carrying him around the whole party? We're never going to marry you off, Angie.
Inside, a man studies a painting, then turns to an attractive woman.
Picasso. Blue period.
Nick approaches.
The artist's name is Kandinsky. Vasily Kandinsky. German, of Russian extraction, 1866 to 1944. And by the way, Picasso's blue period was figurative and ended in 1904. And these watercolors are abstract, done in 1911.
The man glares at Nick, then looks at the woman. She lifts her eyebrows and he shakes his head.
Picasso.
Now outside, Nick jumps up onto a bench.
Hey, everyone, pipe down. I'm about to give a speech. Thank you for coming. Now, I always say the sign of a good party is when I'm having a better time than anyone else. But now is the time when you're expected to ante up for drinking all my liquor and eating all my food and spilling tomato sauce on my couch, Bobby Long. You didn't think I saw you?
The bearded man gives an embarrassed smile.
Oh, he's insufferable.
We are here to raise a vast sum of money for the Small Fry School, right? So while you are reaching for your checkbooks, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Mrs. Rebecca Tingley, our totally ravishing and completely adorable headmistress.
Nick offers his hand to Rebecca and helps her onto the bench.
First of all, I'd like to start by introducing a few members of my valuable staff to you today.
Oh, God.
I give you our dedicated teacher and head of admissions, Miss Angela Green.
Yay!
The tall brunette smiles and waves, then looks at Libby and Maddie. Later, on the deck, Libby passes waiters as they pick up empty glasses. She approaches Nick, who sits on a chaise lounge smoking a cigar.
What are you thinking about?
She sits down beside him.
Was I always as rude as I am now?
Absolutely.
They smile at one another. As they kiss, Angie walks onto the deck carrying a glass of wine. Libby notices her and gently pulls away from Nick.
Hi. Come have a seat.
Angie steps over to a bench and sits down facing the couple. Libby snuggles up against Nick in the chaise lounge and smiles at Angie.
Angela, do you think we ought to break the news to her?
I suppose it's better she hears it from us than from someone else.
She's not going to be happy about it.
What's up, guys?
Libby looks at Nick. He smiles.
Close your eyes. Close them.
Libby closes her eyes. Nick stands and brings Libby to her feet.
Stand down. Closed.
Nick pulls her into dance position. As the couple gently rocks back and forth, Angie stands. Nick turns Libby toward the sea.
Now, Libby, what is your favorite thing?
Me?
Not even close.
All right, open.
Libby opens her eyes. On the water, a sailboat passes behind pine trees.
So I heard Sean Gilman was looking to sell it. I made him an offer. And he agreed to let us take her out for the weekend. And if you like it, it's yours.
If I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can't afford that.
What have I ever let that get in my way? Come on.
What about Maddie? I'll take care of him. We'll have a great time.
Libby beams.
You hate to sail.
Libby gazes at Nick, who lifts his eyebrows playfully. She smiles at the boat, then kisses her husband. Now on the vast blue ocean, the boat's white sails billow in the wind. As the boat glides along the water, white-tipped waves crash against its hull. In the far distance, mountains and stretches of land sit on the horizon. On the boat, Libby stands at the helm, smiling serenely as she steers. Nick emerges from the galley holding a bottle of wine.
Generally, a wine like this, it's time to breathe. No, I don't think we should. Wait.
He looks around.
I don't see land.
Libby grins.
So where is it?
She points to her right.
Alaska's over that way. Japan is straight ahead and Australia's somewhere to the left. Where would you like to go?
Bed.
That can be arranged.
Nick leans into Libby and they kiss. Now the sailboat sits silhouetted against the golden light reflected on the water. Inside, Nick and Libby lay in bed. They smile into each other's eyes. Lying over her, Nick shakes his head and Libby kisses him.
We should do this more often.
Buy expensive sailboats. If this is what happens, they'll buy another one tomorrow.
Nighttime. Libby lies in bed. Her eyes slowly open.
Nick?
As she raises her head from the pillow, she looks at her hands. They're covered in blood.
Nick?
With a furrowed brow, she sits up and examines her bloody hands and robe.
Oh, my God. Nick?
Through the bedroom door, she spots a trail of blood leading to the deck.
Nick!
She stands. As she walks toward the galley, she grimaces at small red puddles and bloody footprints on the floor. Her hands tremble as she holds them up at her shoulders.
Nick?
The edge of a cutting board is covered with blood. Her eyes follow the smeared bloody footprints up the stairs, and she apprehensively follows them. Outside, the rigging sways in the misty air. Libby steps onto the deck.
Nick!
Footprints and pools of blood lead to the metal railing, which is smeared with more blood.
Nick! Nick! Nick!
Looking down, she spots a bloodied knife. Libby picks it up.
Oh, my God.
A bright light shines on her as a boat approaches.
Morning Star! This is the Coast Guard! Put the knife down, ma'am, and step away!
I don't know where my husband is!
Daytime. At a dock, a crowd gathers as a reporter faces a camera. Libby stands next to a police officer. They watch a Coast Guard boat near the landing. The officer nods to Libby and approaches the boat. Libby bows her head. Behind the Coast Guard boat, a small rubber boat carries men in scuba gear. Libby watches as a Coast Guardsman approaches the officer. With a furrowed brow, she raises her hand to her forehead and shields her eyes from the sun. The officer and the Coast Guardsman shake hands, and the officer slowly heads back to Libby.
Anything?
No.
Cut Cutter, please don't let him give up. He's very strong. He's a very strong man.
Cutter walks her away from the boats.
The raft and life preservers are all on board. These guys, they track the wind, currents. It's nothing. The water temperature overnight is 51 degrees. It's cold. It's really cold.
God, I can't breathe.
Just put your head down. Put your head down.
She bends over.
That's a deep breath. It's a big breath.
Cutter squeezes her shoulders comfortingly. Now, on the shore in front of Libby's house, Libby sits wearing a brimmed straw hat. She gently wipes her cheek and gazes around sadly. Nearby, Maddie walks along the rocky shore and throws stones in the water. A sheriff's SUV pulls to a stop under a pine tree. Maddie looks up at the SUV as Cutter, Bobby, and another officer get out of the vehicle.
Mommy, look!
As Libby looks at the SUV, Maddie rushes toward the men. While the second officer waits at the vehicle, Cutter and Bobby head for Libby. Maddie runs past Bobby. As Bobby approaches Libby, she smiles.
Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Libby. Well, Cutter, he asked me to come by and talk to you, you know, just not as an attorney, just as a friend. The inquest was held this morning, and they reviewed all the evidence, and Nick, well, he's officially been declared dead.
Now, Libby, they determined it was a wrongful death, and you... Oh, she's... You're being formally charged with his murder, and I'm here to advise you, make no statements whatsoever to the sheriff.
Libby stares at Bobby with tearful eyes.
I'm sorry, Libby.
Cutter hesitantly pulls out handcuffs. Libby gapes. Now in a jail cell, Libby sits on a gray bench and gazes off despondently. She turns her head as an officer leads Bobby to her cell. Wearing a suit, Bobby stands by holding a briefcase as the officer opens her cell door. The officer leaves. Libby steps out of her cell and faces Bobby.
I'm sorry, Libby. The judge denied his bail.
Libby stares slack-jawed at Bobby's somber face. They sit down at a table outside of her cell. He opens his briefcase, then looks at Libby.
Let's take a look at this, see what we can do.
Bobby, here's what I think happened. I had some wine, okay? And I fell asleep. It must have been the sun. And maybe Nick was trying to cut a snagged line or something, because the knife from the galley was on deck. And maybe the boat pitched or something. And he cut himself. And he tried to come downstairs. He tried to come below to wake me up.
Libby looks over at Bobby's briefcase, spots a pack of cigarettes and a lighter, and grabs them. She puts a cigarette to her lips and tries to light it.
Quit these things before I met Nick.
Bobby puts his hand on hers.
It'll be all right. I promise you. So, why don't we take a look at this first guarantee life? Now, you both bought life insurance policies from the company around 4 months ago.
Libby brushes away a tear and nods.
And you are the beneficiary.
I'm his wife.
Libby, you know this policy is worth $2 million.
Nick wanted to make sure that if anything ever happened to him, we'd be okay.
I'm just afraid the jury may feel there's a big difference between okay and $2 million. They may see it as a motive.
Is that what they're saying out there?
No one is saying. I don't think we have to be concerned about something.
I killed Nick for money?
Libby rises to her feet, takes a few steps away from Bobby, then turns back to him.
I mean, I know we had some problems and Nick worried, but
Libby,
we were okay.
Libby, two of his investors were suing him for embezzlement. First Seattle issued a lien on all his real estate properties, your personal possessions. Now, Nick's death means all these little problems disappear behind a corporate shield, leaving you with $2 million.
She stares at the wall, then walks toward Bobby.
Do you think I killed him?
It's the first rule of being a lawyer. What we think doesn't matter.
It matters to me.
Bobby lights a cigarette and fixes his gaze on Libby.
No, of course. I don't think you killed him.
Now, in a courtroom, a lawyer questions a witness.
Petty Officer Young, What was the condition of the Morning Star's Marine Band radio when you had a chance to inspect it?
The handset cord had been cut.
And as you initially approached the sailboat, what did you see?
Mrs. Parsons was holding a knife.
The prosecutor holds a tube containing the bloody knife.
I show you State's Exhibit number 4.
Now an audio tape plays.
Mayday! This is the Morning Star.
State your emergency, Morning Star.
I've been stabbed. I'm bleeding. My name's Nicholas Parsons. Oh, God!
Now Libby takes the stand.
Mrs. Parsons, you've heard the testimony presented to this court, and your explanation is that somebody must have come aboard the Morning Star.
That's right.
Well, let's consider all the possibilities. Maybe a band of pirates. Or aliens. Did aliens murder your husband? No. Aliens weren't beneficiaries in your husband's life insurance
policy. Objection. Your Honor, the prosecutor's
objection.
I told you what happened.
Yes, you did. You told us that you were asleep.
Yes.
Maybe you were sleepwalking when you stabbed your husband.
Objection. Please, Miss Halliwell, questioning the witness or making a closing argument.
Withdrawn.
I didn't kill my husband. I love my husband. Bobby, I did not kill my husband. You have to leave me.
Now at the jailhouse, Libby sits in a room with glass walls and watches Maddie play with action figures at a long table. Sunlight filters into the room through slats in the blinds. As Libby stares off sadly, Angie sits at the table with Maddie.
I'm sorry, Libby.
It's not your fault, Bobby.
Teary-eyed, Libby turns her head and looks out the window.
I want to ask you something, Angie. I'd like you to adopt my son. No, I can't do that, not to you.
I've thought it through. I barely survived my parents' house. I'm not going to put him there.
Angie stands and moves toward the window.
Money won't be a problem because there's the $2 million from the life insurance and it's going into a trust fund in his name.
It isn't about money.
Libby smiles and mouths the words, I know.
Maddie loves you.
The women's eyes fill with tears. Angie smiles and nods her head.
Thank you. Hey, kiddo. Come see me.
Libby smiles brightly as she places Maddie on her lap.
You're gonna go stay with Angie for a while, okay, kiddo?
Okay.
And you're gonna have lots of fun. And I know you're gonna be a good boy, right?
Yes, Mommy.
And as soon as all this is over, we'll be together again. That's a promise, kiddo. Okay.
Libby cradles his face in her hand. She caresses his cheek. Burying her nose in his hair, she breathes in deeply, then kisses his nose and forehead. Now, in a darkened room, Libby lies on a pillow with her hand tucked under her head. Her puffy eyes stare blankly toward the ceiling. As she blinks, her eyes well with tears. Libby shudders, looks around her, then slowly sits up on the top of a bunk bed. Dozens more line the wall beside her. As fluorescent lights flicker on, other women sit up in their beds. Below Libby, an African-American woman glares up at her. Another woman with long, curly hair approaches.
Who's this?
Rich bitch from Whidbey Island. She ain't gonna make it.
What do you think? A year?
Five Cotton says she offs herself inside of 6 months.
Deal.
Get away from me.
Hey, take it easy. We're your new best friends.
Heard you did your husband. Probably deserved it.
Mine did.
The women walk away. Now in the prison yard, female inmates in blue shirts and jeans socialize. Now inmates and visitors sit on either side of a glass partition. They talk to each other through phone receivers. Angie and Maddie face Libby.
That way,
I know what a pain it is to get here.
I taught him how to say the ABCs.
Is that true?
Yes. Did you learn the alphabet, sweetie?
Yeah.
Can you tell me?
A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Libby puts her hand to the glass, and Maddie presses his hand against it.
Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, and Z. Now I know my ABCs.
Libby sings along with her son, then smiles. Nighttime. Bright lights illuminate the prison grounds, which are fortified by high metal fences and layers upon layers of razor wire. Daytime. Libby uses a payphone while others wait in line behind her.
Give it up. Come on.
At night, Libby lies in bed sobbing. In the lower bunk, the African-American woman lies on her side. Wide awake, she turns her head and gazes up toward Libby. She shifts back onto her side and looks off sadly. Now, in the prison yard, Libby sits on a bench. The back of her shirt reads Department of Corrections. The African-American lady, Evelyn, and the curly-haired woman, Margaret, approach. They sit on either side of Libby. Evelyn reaches into Libby's shirt pocket and pulls out a pack of cigarettes. She shows them to Margaret, who takes one.
Ooh, you're low on cigarettes. If you want to make any friends, I advise you buy another pack fast. On account of your personality, it ain't the best I've ever seen.
Are you trying to reach your friend, the one with your boy?
Yeah, I can't find him. He disappeared.
Oh, hon. If you could disappear that easy, believe you me, I wouldn't be here right now.
Me either.
Evelyn leaves, and Margaret leans into Libby.
Think. Use your head. There's got to be a way to track him down.
Margaret raises her eyebrows and leaves. Libby stares off, her brow furrowed. Now, Libby holds a payphone in front of a long line of prisoners.
Small Fry School, front office.
Hello, this is Angela Green calling.
Angie, it's Jennifer.
Yes, hi, how are you? Yes, it's nice to hear your voice. Listen, I haven't gotten a severance check in a while, and I was hoping I could verify with you that you have my correct mailing address and phone number.
Sure, I'll check. Can you hold on a second?
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Yeah, I have it right here. Now tell me if this is right. 3321 Mason Street, San Francisco.
Libby writes down the information.
The phone number is 415.
Elsewhere.
Hello?
Angie? Angie?
Libby, I've tried to call you 1,000 times.
Is Maddie okay?
Yeah,
where is
fine.
He?
Everything is fine.
What are you doing in San Francisco?
Put him on the phone.
Hey, why are you acting this way?
Because you disappeared and I haven't seen my son in a month.
I was just about to call you.
Oh, bull.
How can you move and not tell me, Angie?
We were coming to see you next week.
Just put Maddie on the phone.
Angie bites her bottom lip. She looks at the receiver, then turns to Maddie.
Maddie, it's Mommy. Come say hi.
Maddie stops playing with his toys, walks over to Angie, and takes the phone.
Hi, Mommy.
Hello, sweetie pie. Oh, how are you, Maddie? I think about you all the time, honey. I miss you so much. Are you doing okay, kiddo?
I love you.
Listen, Maddie, I know that this has been really hard. But Angie's going to bring you up to see me next week, okay?
Yes, Mommy.
Nick enters.
Daddy!
Angie takes the phone.
Nick?
Nick gapes at Angie, who mouths, "It's Libby." He hurries to the phone. Libby's brow furrows.
Nick?
Nick rips the phone cord from the wall, then lovingly holds Maddie's face in his hands. In the prison, Libby frantically redials the number. In the apartment, Nick lets go of Maddie, then glances up at Angie. As he walks to a window, Angie looks at the phone in her hand. Meanwhile, Libby holds the phone to her ear. She hangs up the receiver and stares questioningly at the phone. Her brow furrows as she turns away. The inmates around her move in slow motion as she makes her way through the crowd at the wall of payphones. She steps through a metal gate and enters the sleeping quarters. Oblivious to her surroundings, she bumps into people as she makes her way past the rows of bunk beds. Later, as Libby lies in her bed, she studies a photo of her son. He stands outside wearing a yellow and black raincoat, a red wide-brimmed hat, and a bag draped over his chest. Later, Libby talks on an outdoor payphone.
He was in San Francisco last night. I have a phone number, but it's already been disconnected. No, I don't have a forwarding address. He's gone. Well, don't you have investigators? Doesn't your company want to get its $2 million back? Why aren't you listening to me? I am innocent.
Yeah, you are!
Libby storms off. Evelyn watches with a concerned gaze, then takes a drag on a cigarette. Later, in the prison kitchen, Libby, wearing a white hairnet and apron, stirs a gigantic pot with a spoon the length of a broom handle. Margaret approaches.
Put some elbow grease behind that stir. Nobody wants to eat any burnt tapioca.
Does it smell like it's burning?
Oh, I swear you got spit for brains, girl. You're in prison. Do you get that? Nobody wants to listen to anybody in prison. So you can just forget about reopening your case or a jailhouse appeal. You got that? They take years, and they're 95% unsuccessful. So if you want my advice...
No.
Well, you're going to get it. You do your time.
So what are you now, a lawyer?
Margaret glances around.
Once upon a time?
She walks over to Libby.
But they tend to disbar murderers. And here's your Christmas present. You ready?
Pay attention, because this is the best jailbird advice you're ever going to get.
You ever hear of something called double jeopardy, Fifth Amendment to the Constitution? Huh? No? Well, double jeopardy provides that no person may be tried for the same crime twice. You got that? Keep staring. The state says you already killed your husband. They can't convict you of it a second time. That means that when you leave here, you track him down, and when you find him, you can kill him. Kind of makes you feel warm and tingly all over, don't it? That's right. Keep stirring.
Now, outside, Libby exercises. A block of weights pass in front of her determined gaze as they steadily rise and fall. Later, she clutches a weight to her chest and does sit-ups. Now, on a rainy day, Libby runs the perimeter of the empty prison yard. Evelyn watches her.
I gotta hand it to you, honey. You just sheer hate driving you all.
Libby continues to run in her rain-soaked clothing. Now, in the prison's beauty salon, a long-haired Libby looks at a magazine clipping of a model, then to a frizzy-haired woman.
Honey, the only way you're going to look like that is if I staple a picture to your forehead. Just trust me, okay?
As Libby brushes the lady's hair, Evelyn enters carrying a cake lit with candles.
Maddie's 8th birthday, honey.
Libby smiles as Evelyn approaches with the cake. Libby takes a deep breath and blows out the candles. Evelyn smiles as she removes the candles from the cake. The words Happy Birthday, Maddie are written in white icing.
You know, Evelyn, I read that even if a child is separated from its mother the day it's born, it never forgets her voice. Think that's true?
Margaret looks at Evelyn out of the corners of her eyes. Evelyn smiles.
Of course I do.
Libby's eyes tear up as she smiles back. Now outside, Libby walks with Margaret and Evelyn.
I feel like I've grown these past 6 years.
Grown? Honey, they don't want to hear that you've turned into some kind of tree, okay? So you just repeat after me. If I could trade places with my husband, I would.
Oh, if I could trade places with my husband, I would.
That's good. Not throwing a lot of that born-again
stuff.
Listen.
I want you to start with this. I'm not sitting in front of you today to make excuses.
Now Libby sits in front of the parole board.
I'm not trying to make any excuses. I killed my husband. I've had to live with that every day for the past 6 years. But I swear to you that I'm a changed person.
Why should we believe you?
I don't think I can ask you to believe me. All I can really do is believe in myself. And know that if I were given a chance, I could do something good with my life. Make up for the wrong I did.
Daytime, on a busy city sidewalk, Libby makes her way down the street holding a cardboard box. The sun shines brightly and Libby squints as she looks around. Now, as Libby approaches a gray three-story building, she passes by a group of men loitering in front of a store.
Oh, mommy. Hey, hey, talk to me.
Ignoring them, she walks up a flight of stairs to the front door and enters the building.
Come in.
As Libby enters a room, a man with short, graying hair and weathered features sits down at his desk. He opens a folder, pulls out her mugshot, then looks at her.
I'm Elizabeth Parsons.
What do you have in that box?
Libby puts the box on his desk. The man stands up and rummages through it.
Elizabeth Parsons.
He holds up a bra.
State of Washington has granted you a conditional parole. For the next 3 years, you'll observe all the rules of this facility, which means no fighting, no fornicating, no drinking, no drugs, no exceptions, no excuses. Do you understand that?
Yes.
This is your social security card. You will find gainful and sustained employment. You're not to carry a firearm or a weapon of any kind, especially a knife. Curfew is at 8:30.
The parole officer sits down and holds up the picture of Maddie.
Is this a problem for you?
No.
Yes, it is. Do you want to tell me about it?
No.
I'm going to have trouble with you, Parsons.
No, sir, no, you're not. I learned my lesson. I just want
to... I'm not interested in your damn contrition. I'm interested in your behavior. Get out of here and behave yourself. You're in room 8 on the second floor.
Libby picks up her box and heads for the door. The parole officer aims a remote at his TV. Now, in a large multi-floor library, Libby stands at a computer research station. Behind her, a college kid checks out two girls as they pass him. The guy continues on. Spotting Libby, he stops and looks at her computer screen.
Well, you're never going to get anywhere like that.
He reaches over and types on her keyboard. A page pops up on the screen. The title reads, Northwest Lib Link.
Nice shampoo.
Libby rolls her eyes.
Now, what are you looking for?
A friend I haven't seen for a couple years. Someone said I should try the internet.
It's a boy friend?
Girl.
Okay, well, in that case, I'll help you. Does your friend have email?
I have no idea.
Okay, come on. Let's do some surfing. So, what's your friend's name?
Angela Green.
Zip code?
Libby shakes her head.
How about a social security number? That way we could run a credit report and it'll give us her address.
She was a school teacher.
Done deal.
Another page pops up. Washington State Department of Education Administration and Directory information. The guy enters Angela's name.
And voila. Now, maybe when this thing is finished with searching, we could go to this, this neat little bar now and, have a little drink. What do you say?
Yeah, I just have to check in with my parole officer first.
The guy's smile fades.
So, what did you do, not pay parking tickets?
Oh, no, I was convicted of murdering my husband.
He stares with a skeptical smile.
You're kidding, right?
No, I'm not. Sliced and diced, the paper called it. Can you believe that?
Oh, look, I just remembered I have, this appointment with the...
See ya.
See ya.
The guy hurries off. Libby watches him go with an annoyed glance, then turns her attention to the screen. It reads, search results for Angela Green, 1,071 matches.
Oh, my God.
Now, in Libby's room at the halfway house, one woman brushes another's hair.
So he takes me out for dinner and he feeds me escargot. Do you know what those are?
Yeah.
Snails. Snails, yuck. But anyway, the moment I go to bed with him, the airhead dumps me. Jeez, man. What was his name?
Libby and her roommate step into the hall where the parole officer interrogates a parolee.
Wait, I don't like it. Would you call me dirty names?
Please, Mr. Layman, don't do this to me, man, okay? I didn't do nothing.
Where were you this afternoon, Libby?
I was at my job.
You were down on Pike Street wearing lime green hot pants and fishnets.
I was on my way to work, man.
At McDonald's.
Yes,
those clothes?
That's
you haven't
right.
been at work in a week. Get your stuff.
Two police officers look on.
I won't do it again. I promise that.
You blew off your parole. You're going back. It's that simple.
As Ruby charges for Layman, he grabs her arm and forces her to the floor. The officers approach.
You're a dirty girl, Ruby.
I want one chance! I just want one chance!
You'll send me back there, it'll kill me, you mean son of a...
The officers drag her away. Layman looks to the crowd of women in the hall.
Show's over, go to sleep.
As the women start to head back to their rooms, Layman looks at Libby.
You think I'm a mean son of a bitch?
I think you could have given her a second chance.
There are no second chances in this house, baby. This is the last chance house. You try to understand that?
Now, sunlight shines on a ferry boat as it moves over the ocean. On board, Libby peers anxiously at the approaching shore. Now, on a school playground, Libby walks with Rebecca, the headmistress.
Libby, it's wrong of you to be here.
It's very wrong.
I'm sorry to bother you,
but you're my only hope.
Sharon, no, you put that down, please. Libby, I'm sorry, I can't.
I want to find my son.
Maddie's had 6 years with Angie. I mean, think about it, Libby, 6 years. Oh, Benjamin, that's a great sandcastle. If you come back into his life right now, it's just going to cause more disruption and pain. Just think about it, Libby, please. Think about it.
I just want to see him, Rebecca. Can you give me an address for Angie so I can see him?
Look, I'm sorry. I really am sorry.
Rebecca walks away.
Lauren, come on, get down, please. That's it.
Nighttime. The log cabin-style school building sits deserted. Libby heads through the playground toward the school. She stops and looks around nervously. Continuing on, she climbs over a chain-link fence and into an outdoor play area. Among scattered toys, a blanket sits on a nearby picnic table. Libby picks it up and approaches a door with a large glass window. She jiggles the handle and pushes on the door. Finding it locked, Libby wraps the blanket around her elbow and smashes the door's window with it. At the halfway house, Layman peers into Libby's room.
Miss Parsons?
I don't know. Not here.
Back in the school, Libby steps into a dark room. She finds a filing cabinet and pulls on one of its drawers. She turns on a small lamp, opens a desk drawer, and searches through various office supplies. Libby turns off the lamp and sneaks over to a window. Peering through the blinds, she spots Cutter and another officer get out of a police jeep. Libby shuts the blinds and yanks on the locked cabinet. She reaches around to the back side of the cabinet and finds a set of keys. Switching the light on again, she tries each one in the cabinet lock. Sweat glistens on her face as she slides in the matching key. In the open drawer, hanging file folders are labeled with each letter of the alphabet. Libby opens one marked G, where she finds files labeled Arthur Grafton and James Greenberg. Frowning, Libby slides the drawer shut, then looks up nervously. Cutter and his partner enter the school and point their flashlights. Libby opens a second drawer filled with worn files. She finds one labeled Angela Green and pulls out a piece of paper. Her eyes focus on the Social Security number. Startled, Libby looks toward the door. She pockets the piece of paper and heads back through the room. As Cutter's partner enters, Libby opens a window.
Cutter, up here!
The officer chases Libby out of the window and onto a roof. He trips, steps on a skylight, and shatters it. As Libby jumps from the roof into a sandbox, Cutter exits the building.
I got her!
Libby climbs over the chain-link fence. Cutter tries to follow, but gets caught at the top. He shines his flashlight on Libby as she dashes into a wooded area. Now, Libby races from the woods onto a beach. Arms pumping, she kicks up sand as she runs. Nearby, the officer's jeep speeds around a dune.
There she is!
In the passenger seat, Cutter gets jostled as his partner turns the jeep toward their suspect. Libby sprints through a shallow inlet. The jeep speeds after her, spraying water out of each side. Hurrying through some beach grass, Libby trips and slides down a sand dune. As she peeks back over the hill, headlights shine on her face. She ducks as the jeep launches from the sloping dune over her. It rolls several times in the sand, tossing its passengers about, and lands on its side. The officers climb out through the open roof and continue the chase on foot. Cutter spots Libby racing along a line of beach fencing. His partner follows. He jumps over the fence and falls. As Libby tries to avoid his rolling body, Cutter tackles her to the ground. He forces her onto her stomach and cuffs her hands behind her back.
Damn it, Libby, what are you doing here?
Libby winces as Cutter puts on the handcuffs. He and his partner drag Libby to her feet. As they walk her back along the shore, the foamy water laps the wet sand beside them. Now, Libby sits in a jail cell and looks off despondently. Her eyes flit around as Cutter approaches. He unlocks the cell door for Layman, who leans against the wall and looks at Libby. She turns around and faces him.
Did you have a nice day at the beach?
Now Layman drives onto a ferry.
You pissed me off, Parsons.
He removes a piece of paper from his pocket. It's the one Libby stole from the school. He reads it.
Angela Green. That's the one that's got your kid, right?
Could we not talk, please, Layman?
Okay. All right. So why'd she skip town?
She just skipped town.
And with your husband, who isn't dead because you didn't kill him? Baloney.
Okay. I killed my husband. I chopped him up into little bits, and I dumped him piece by piece into the Pacific. Are you satisfied?
No. No, you were a hell of a lot closer to your kid 3 days ago than you are today. All you had to do was wait 3 years. That's all. You flaming idiot.
Libby faces Layman with a furrowed brow.
You cannot know what it is like to sit in prison for 6 years and think of nothing else in the world but your son. Did I make the right choice? You asked the wrong question, Layman. I didn't have a choice. Forget your curfew.
They glare at each other. As ferry workers direct Layman to stop behind a red compact, Libby notices a picture of a teenage girl stuck in the sun visor.
Who's that? Your daughter?
Layman frowns and flips the sun visor closed.
Is that a problem for you, Layman?
I'm going up top.
Layman gets out and walks around to the passenger side of the car. He reaches through the open window and grabs Libby's cuffed hands. He unlocks one of the cuffs and attaches it to the outside door handle.
Don't go anywhere.
Libby rolls her eyes. As Layman walks away, she moves her arm, pulling the handcuffs taut. Now sunlight glistens on the calm water as the ferry slowly pulls away from the dock. Inside, Layman sets down a paper cup filled with coffee and adds liquor from a flask. Glancing around, he discreetly pockets the bottle. He blows on his drink and takes a sip. Down below, Libby tugs on the handcuffs. Giving up, she looks around. Her gaze falls on the keys in the car's ignition. Libby looks out her window and notices a large metal pipe standing beside the rear of the car. She stares thoughtfully at it. Up on the passenger deck, Layman moves past other passengers and sips from his coffee. In the car, Libby scoots over and turns the ignition key. She puts the gear shift into reverse and presses down on the gas pedal. The rear of the car slams into a van behind it. Libby gazes nervously over each shoulder at the empty cars around her. She puts the car into drive and steps on the gas. She watches sparks fly as the door handle scrapes the metal pipe. As she glances ahead, the car rams into the red compact. Libby slams on the brakes. The red car rolls overboard. Slack-jawed, Libby glances around, then watches the car float away. Up on deck, Layman sidesteps another passenger as he sips from his coffee. Below, Libby studies the banged-up door handle. She frantically tugs on it with the handcuffs. Layman leans against a railing and looks out at the water. He glimpses the red car as it gets dragged under. Looking down, he spots Libby yanking on the handcuffs. He darts off. Now Libby winces as she tries to pull the handcuffs free. Giving up, she puts the car back into reverse and steers the door handle into the pipe. The car slams into the van again. Libby continues tugging on the handcuffs as Layman races downstairs. His feet barely touch the steps. Libby spots him exit the stairwell and locks the driver's door. Layman breaks the window with his gun. As he opens the door, Libby puts the car in drive and slams on the gas. Layman gets inside as the car rolls off the back of the ferry. Libby and Layman jostle about and his gun lands on the dashboard. The ferry passengers gape.
Oh my God.
As the car fills with water, Layman crawls over Libby and reaches for the handcuffs. On the ferry's bridge, the captain quickly spins the wheel. As Layman struggles to release Libby from the door handle, she calmly holds her wrist steady for him. The car sinks further. Shafts of light filter through the surface, lending an eerie blue glow to the water. Layman unlocks the handcuffs, and Libby pulls her arm inside. She quickly grabs the gun from the dashboard and swims through the open window. As Libby pushes herself toward the surface, silvery air bubbles stream from her nose and mouth. Layman follows close behind. Their heads emerge from the water. Layman grabs hold of Libby's jacket. On the ferry, a worker in an orange safety vest tosses a life preserver toward them. As Libby and Layman struggle, she holds him underwater. Letting him back up, she swims away. He grabs her by the hair. She turns and bashes him in the head with the gun. Layman floats, face down in the water. Libby dives under and swims away. On the ferry, passengers gawk. On the surface, Layman reaches for the life preserver with one hand and holds his head with the other. Underwater, Libby puts the gun in her pants waistband. Meanwhile, three ferry workers pull in the life preserver. A few hundred feet away, Libby pokes her head up from the water. She turns toward the ferry and watches the workers pull Layman in on the preserver, then heads back underwater. As the workers help Layman onto the ferry, blood trickles down his forehead. In the crowd of passengers, a young boy glances around and notices Libby climbing onto the shore. She sprints toward a wooded area. Later, Layman sits in an emergency room as a doctor tends to his wound. A young man in a suit stands at the foot of his bed.
Did you voluntarily give her the gun?
Come on, Carl, what do you think? Hey.
Sorry. Were you drinking?
No, I wasn't drinking.
Well, it's been known to happen. Do you have any idea where she's gone?
No.
All right. Well, I think that's about all then, isn't it?
Oh, what?
There'll be an investigation into your actions today. And I wouldn't hold my breath about the prospect of keeping your job.
Carl, give me a break. Come on.
Now on the side of a road, Libby gets out of a semi-truck.
Thanks a lot.
She shields her eyes from the sun and stares ahead. Now, outside of a farmhouse, horses graze in a corral adjacent to a garden. In between rows of tomato vines, Libby watches a woman dig.
Sent your father off to the VFW. He'll be playing gin for hours.
Some things never change.
Oh, it's not as bad as it used to be, you know.
I'm glad for you, Mama.
Libby's mother pulls a tin box from the ground. She brushes off the soil and opens it to reveal a wad of cash. She smiles up at Libby.
I always said there was good money in tomatoes.
She hands the cash to her daughter. Libby's brow furrows as she fingers it. She lets out a breathy laugh, and her mother grins at her. Later, an old green truck coasts down a highway lined with pine trees and farmland. Libby sits at the wheel. Now, in a BMW dealership, Libby runs her hands across the side of a shiny red convertible. A salesman approaches.
So, you're in the market for a BMW?
Yeah, who isn't?
Well, they're the best.
I decided it was finally time to trade up.
Right.
So why don't you check my credit and see if I can finance this?
Great. Let me have your social security number and I'll get the ball rolling.
Now, in an office, the salesman sits at a computer. Libby sits in the driver's seat of the convertible and eyes him through the office window. The salesman approaches Libby with a piece of paper.
20 Oriole Terrace, Evergreen, Colorado. Is that your current address?
20 Oriole Terrace, Evergreen, Colorado? Sure is.
Didn't you say your name is Angela Green? Because this says it's Angela Ryder.
Oh, no. I said Ryder. Angela Ryder.
What about the car?
Libby leaves. Now Layman approaches a woman behind a counter.
That's great, Sorby.
Her eyes widen.
No way. No way, no way. I've been clean, Mr. Travis.
Oh, I know. I believe you. I do. What I need is a search on a lady named Angela Green. I got her social security number here. I'd like you to...
You know I'm not allowed to give up personal information.
Oh, I shouldn't ask you that. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Now in the green truck, Libby drives down a two-lane highway. The sun shines down on pine trees and steep rock walls that flank the road. Thin white clouds float in the sky over lush green mountains. In the distance, snow-covered peaks line the horizon. Later, Libby drives, staring straight ahead with a serene gaze. As she travels, she passes a sign that reads, Exit 22, South 74 Highway, Evergreen, Kittredge. She takes the exit off the highway. Now, large houses with manicured lawns line a residential road. Libby leans forward and peers out the side window. She spots a house with the number 20 over its large front door and pulls over to the side of the road. Looking cautiously over her shoulders, Libby removes Layman's gun from her bag. She flips open the chamber, checks the bullets, and puts it in her pocket. Now sunlight filters down through the trees, leaving patches of light scattered on the two-story beige house. Libby opens a white iron gate and steps in the yard. She apprehensively studies the house. Her eyes fix on the door as she walks up the front steps. She pauses for a moment and swallows nervously. Her gaze shifts to the doorbell, and she presses it. Libby puts her hand in her pocket and cocks the gun. Her eyes dart from side to side. A 10-year-old boy opens the door. Libby studies him.
Hi.
The corners of her mouth slowly turn up. The blue-eyed boy squints at Libby.
Who is it, Sam?
Oh, some lady.
A woman appears holding an infant.
May I help you?
I'm looking for my friend Angela Ryder. I thought this was her address.
I've never heard of her. But we've just moved in. Maybe you should check with the woman who lives next door. She's been here 40 years.
Libby approaches an old lady in her garden.
Dearie, whatever you're selling, I've already got two of them.
I'm just looking for my friend, Angela Ryder. She used to live next door.
The lady looks up at her.
Oh, I'm sorry to be the one to tell you, but Angie died in the accident. It was 3 or 4 years ago. It was one of those awful things. The gas stove in their house was leaking. The explosion knocked out some of my windows, and...
What about the boy?
Matty is such a dear child. No, he and Simon weren't there when it happened. Poor Simon. I've never seen anyone so grief-stricken.
Oh, I'm sure.
Now, Layman hurries through an airport terminal. In a library, Libby searches through newspaper articles on a microfilm machine. She stops at an article titled, Local Woman Killed in Gas Explosion. She squints, flips a switch to illuminate the negative film, and reads the article. Below the headline, a picture shows Angela smiling brightly. Meanwhile, Layman stands in the old lady's yard.
It would really help if you could remember what kind of car she was driving.
Well, it was an old truck.
Yeah?
It's, I don't know what year or make or anything.
Well, what color was it?
At an outdoor cafe, Libby studies a photocopy of the newspaper article. Her eyebrows arch and she cocks her head. She stares closely at Angie's picture. Behind Angie, a painting hangs on the wall. Libby focuses on it. She straightens and looks up with a serious gaze. She notices the storefront of a fine art gallery, then looks down the street and spots another one. Now, inside one of the galleries.
Kandinsky. Bit out of our reach, I'm afraid. I have a few Picasso and Chagall lithographs.
No, it's Kandinsky that I'm particularly interested in, especially the Blue Rider period. I love that.
Well, let's check art scan.
In a back room, images of paintings scroll down on a computer screen.
Lovely 1922 Kandinsky lithograph.
The 1911 is all that interests me.
Now, Layman drives a car. His gaze fixes on Libby's green truck, which is parked in a lot. He steers toward it. Back in the art gallery.
Stop. There. Yes.
What?
Yes, that's it.
No, I'm afraid we've missed that. It was sold to a museum in Munich 6 months ago.
Do you think you could find who sold it? Perhaps they have more.
Well, yes, let's see.
The gallery owner gazes over his shoulder.
Excuse me a moment.
Libby watches him leave the room, then sits down at the computer.
Yes, sir. Can I help you?
Oh, yes. My name is Travis Wayne.
Libby worriedly glances over her shoulder, then turns back to the computer. She clicks the mouse on the word provenance. On screen, three names appear. She clicks on the third name, Jonathan Devereaux. As an address pops up, she glances over her shoulder. Turning back to the computer, she grabs a pen and paper and writes down the address, 820 St. Louis Street, New Orleans, Louisiana. Layman appears in the doorway. The room is empty, and the back door is wide open. Outside, Layman's blue car sits parked sideways, blocking Libby's truck. She gets into the pickup. Libby starts the engine and backs up into his car, smashing its windows and sending it reeling across the parking lot. Libby backs up the truck and slams her foot onto the accelerator. The truck plows into the blue car, flipping it over. As Layman runs out of the gallery, Libby glances at him and speeds away. He chases after her on foot. As Libby swerves through an intersection, other cars skid to a stop. Up ahead, a black truck backs into the road. Libby slams on the brakes. Over her shoulder, she spots Layman running toward her. Libby drives onto the sidewalk and toward a man on a payphone. As the truck speeds into it, the phone booth goes flying. The stunned man looks at the truck as he holds the phone receiver. Layman jogs to a stop and watches Libby careen back onto the street and down the road. The gallery owner catches up to Layman and gazes after Libby.
she seem? Sarah Five.
I would really like to know what that woman wanted in your gallery.
The man looks at Lehman curiously. Now, in a plane, Libby sleeps with her head resting against the window. She adjusts a pillow under her neck and uncomfortably shifts in her seat. Later, Libby holds a map as she walks down a bustling sidewalk. She crosses the street and passes vendors selling paintings, refreshments, and psychic readings. A singing quartet sways and snaps their fingers in the middle of a pedestrian road. Libby continues down the crowded street past them. Later, on a different street, her eyes fix on a large brick building with green shutters. Flags hang from a second-floor balcony. Out front, a porter loads bags into a car's trunk, then hails a taxi. Libby squints at the building sign, 820 Rue Saint-Louis, Maison Beaucoup. An image of a red crown topped with a heart sits between the words on the sign. Inside, Libby enters the posh foyer. To her right, a concierge sits at an antique writing desk. In front of her, a crystal chandelier hangs over a round table. A grand staircase with a carved wooden railing leads to a second floor. Libby notices a sign. The annual bachelor's auction, Saturday, October 2nd. A desk clerk notices her.
Can I help you?
Libby walks over to her.
I'm looking for Jonathan Devereaux.
Mr. Devereaux's out right now. He'll be back tonight for the party.
Well, is Maddie here?
I don't believe I know you, ma'am. Maybe you'd like to leave a message.
As Libby smiles and walks away, the clerk watches her suspiciously. Now, outside, Libby strolls down the sidewalk past elegant stores. Across the street, she notices a building with dresses in the window. Now, inside a classy hotel, marble floors gleam under large chandeliers. Libby walks to the front desk and fingers some brochures beside a silver-haired guest.
It's certainly a pleasure having stay with us here at Martinoli's Scratch.
There. My suite has a view.
Your room has a lovely view from Mississippi, Mrs. Scratch.
And I need a masseuse.
I'll send Jerome right up. Bruce? 1420, Mrs. Scratch. Hello.
Libby nods at the clerk as she walks away. Inside the hotel boutique, a saleswoman notices Libby dressed in slacks and a jersey. As Libby runs her fingers through a fringed shawl, the saleswoman looks her up and down, then approaches her.
I'm sorry, are you lost?
No, actually, I'm found. I just had an hour with Jerome.
Oh, Jerome. I've heard that he is marvelous.
He's fabulous. I haven't felt this good since the day my husband died. So I've got something for tonight, but I think I need Armani.
Yes, very good, Mrs.
Critch, suite 1420.
Of course.
I'll be charging it to my room.
The saleswoman goes over to a computer. On screen, Mrs. Critch's information appears.
Now, Mrs. Critch, I would say that you are a size 4?
A 2.
Of course.
Nighttime. In a police station, a gray-haired man in a shirt and tie enters through a door labeled Case Room. He holds a coffee mug.
There's a guy waiting for you.
The man continues on, turns a corner, and stops in an office doorway. Inside, Lehman looks up at a large fish mounted on a wooden plaque. Lehman turns to him.
Did you catch that thing?
The gray-haired man nods.
What'd you use for bait?
I caught that big bucket-mouth son of a bitch off an old rebel lure my daddy left me. Of course, there's buzz bombs, poppers, jigs, all kinds of things work back in these waters. I'm Jim Mangold.
Travis Lehman, Washington Department of Corrections.
What can I do for you?
Lehman hands him a photo of Libby.
Who's this?
That's somebody I'm looking for.
Pretty girl?
Oh, yeah, she's very pretty for a convicted murderer.
Mr. Lehman, I'd love to be able to help you, sir.
No, I don't want you guys to go any trouble. I can handle matters. I just came down as a professional courtesy since she's in New Orleans and she came here to kill one of your prominent citizens.
And just how is she planning on doing that?
I don't know. She probably used the .38 special she stole from me.
Mangold stares at Lehman with raised eyebrows.
Roy Lee! Get these in the works now!
Now, outside the Maison Beaucoup, doormen take the invitations of elegantly dressed people. Libby approaches wearing a glittering V-neck gown. Her smoky eyes focus straight ahead under her upswept hair. As she crosses the street, an open carriage decorated with fresh flowers pulls up in front of the hotel. She heads for the couple emerging from the carriage. The woman wears a red shawl.
Good evening.
What a remarkable wrap. Where on earth did you find that?
Well, the first lady asked me the same thing when we stayed at the White House, and I wouldn't tell her either.
Oh, I got it right here. Enjoy your evening. Good evening.
Good evening.
Libby tags along with the couple past the doormen. Inside, a band plays.
Imagine how work makes you go berserk. Trying to hit the worst bitch.
As Libby enters the ballroom, the couple from the carriage joins other couples on a crowded dance floor. The couples rock and twirl under crystal chandeliers as others mingle off to the side. With alert eyes, Libby makes her way through the crowd. As she passes a tray of crystal champagne flutes, she smiles and takes one. She stares at two men who eye her. Scanning the crowd, she studies the faces around her. As the guests applaud, Libby faces the stage. A white-haired man addresses the crowd.
Good evening, madams and messieurs. We're delighted you're with us this evening on this very special occasion. And as is the custom in New Orleans since even before the War of Northern Aggression, we offer the ladies of this fair city our first bachelor to be placed on the auction block, our host, Jonathan Devereaux.
Behind a crowd of people, Libby spots a man in a white dinner jacket. Her gaze intently follows him as he weaves in between the guests and hops on stage. He faces the crowd. It's Nick.
Y'all having a good time? All right. Now then, ladies, what you see before you is a moderately presentable man in his 30s, given unhealthy thoughts and a dissipated lifestyle.
He lifts a cigar.
With, and this is what's going to cost you the really big money.
He takes off his jacket and tosses it to a man beside the stage.
Absolutely no redeeming moral virtue.
At the back of the room, Libby glares. A woman raises her hand.
500.
Dear woman, my cufflinks cost more than that. Do I hear 1,000?
1,000.
Thank you.
A blonde gives him a toothy grin.
2,000.
A redhead lifts her arm. The crowd gawks.
All right, now did I just hear the voice of the charming Miss Monroe? Because I was just starting to worry. Begin to think you didn't care.
2,500.
Nick gapes in the direction of the bid. Several people in the crowd look over their shoulders.
2,500. We have a new bidder. 2,500.
3,000.
He smiles at the redhead.
5,000.
Again, Nick's eyes scan the crowd. From her seat, the redhead casts a sidelong glance toward Libby. Nick nods, then gazes at the redhead.
5,500.
The crowd turns and looks at her.
Well, we have 5,500. We'll,
He peers toward Libby.
Will the lady take us to 6?
Heads turn to the back of the room.
$10,000.
Nick nervously licks his lips.
Well, see, I mean, alas, someone who knows my true value.
Libby gazes coldly.
Now, Ms. Monroe, I believe the bid is to you at $10,500.
Ms. Monroe shakes her head.
Well, you can have him, honey. Believe me, he ain't worth that much. I know from personal experience.
Yeah. Thank you, honey.
Libby rolls her eyes.
Going once. Going twice. So, woman in the back. $10,000.
Nick's eyes search the crowd.
Would you like to come forward and claim your prize, young lady?
As the crowd parts, Libby appears. Nick's stare hardens. She breezes to the stage with her eyes fixed on him.
Hello, Nick.
Nick forces a polite smile. Libby studies his face.
Well, aren't you going to give me a kiss?
Nick's eyes flip nervously.
I think I've earned it.
He steps closer and leans his face toward hers. Libby quickly turns away from him. Nick gives the audience a good-natured smile, then glares at Libby, tightening his lips. As he follows Libby off stage, he grabs his jacket. They walk through the crowd.
I'll make this real easy for you, Nick. I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. You used to love a good deal, didn't you?
We just take this someplace private.
I don't think so. I remember what happened the last time we were alone.
I don't believe we met. I'm Suzanne Monroe.
I'm Libby. I'm his wife.
Ms. Monroe's eyes widen.
Well, Jonathan. A minute ago a bachelor, now you're married. You don't waste any time.
She looks at Libby.
You been in Nolens long?
I'm just passing through town to pick up my child. I'll be leaving very soon.
Oh, nice.
We're finally putting the past behind us and moving on with our lives, aren't we, Jonathan?
Sure.
I do have one question, though. How long were Angie and you cheating before you decided to get rid of me?
Ms. Monroe smiles at Jonathan and sticks out her head expectantly.
Would you excuse us, please?
Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
She grins as Nick slinks off with Libby.
Where is he, Nick?
Libby.
You destroyed my life, and I will destroy yours unless you give me Maddie. Listen. That's all I want.
Listen, let me explain something to you. You have to understand something. We were going under. We were going to lose everything.
He locks his eyes on hers.
And if I'd had any guts, I would have killed myself, but I was trying to protect you. That's why I got the life insurance.
Libby's eyes narrow.
So I would be out of the picture, and you and Maddie would be okay. And I just never believed they would convict you.
Libby nods.
They did, Nick.
Nick glances around.
And the thing with Angie happened later. It was a nightmare. And the worst part of it was being away from you.
So is that why you killed her?
Nick lets out nervous laughter.
That was an accident.
Nice try, Nick. I'm not buying. It's garbage.
I will swear on the light of our son.
Oh, don't you freaking dare.
Nick closes his mouth.
You can keep your hotel, your fancy accent, and your new name. Just give me Maddie.
I understand.
No, now.
It's
give him to me now.
It's the middle of the night. I can't just walk away from here. No, I don't think you're stupid.
Can we let you slip away once again?
It's too far to Maddie's school, and you've got to be patient.
I've been patient for 6 years. I want my child.
Over Nick's shoulder, Libby spots Layman pushing through the crowd.
I'll call you tomorrow, Nick. Around.
Libby slips into the crowd. She stops a few yards from Layman with her back to him.
Excuse me, do you know where Mr. Devereaux is?
He's at the bar, sir.
Over here?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
As Layman moves on, Libby glances back, then quickly makes her way toward the exit. Later, Nick looks at Libby's mugshot, then tosses it on the bar in front of Layman.
I'm sorry. Oh, thank you, Marcel. Can I offer you a drink?
Oh,
no, but wait a second. Let me guess. I'll take it for scotch and soda. Huh?
I'll have a Diet Coke, please.
Well, all right, but I bet you used to drink now you're on the wagon. $10 says I'm right.
You sure you've never seen this woman before?
No, I'm positive.
Oh, okay.
But let me get it straight, though. She believes that I'm her husband.
Oh, yeah.
Whom she killed.
Yes, sir.
That's pretty far-fetched.
Far-fetched or not, she is in New Orleans. She does have a gun. She is looking for you.
Well, thank you. I'll alert our security people.
You do that.
Now, in the rain, Libby holds a red umbrella over her head. Her brow furrows as she pushes past the people on the crowded street. Nearby, at the wheel of a parked patrol car, a cop spots Libby. The cop types a command on his keyboard, and a small screen shows Libby's mugshots. Now, in the police station.
Let's go, Layman. We spotted your girl.
Layman follows Mangold out. In the street, the squad car's wipers sweep quickly across the windshield. As the patrolman's sedan crawls through the foot traffic, he keeps his eye on Libby. Keeping her gaze straight ahead, Libby bites her lower lip and clutches her red umbrella. Up ahead, a mounted policeman notices her and stops his horse. As lightning flashes, the horse rears up. The cop brings his steed under control and Libby takes off. Nearby, Mangold looks around slack-jawed, then turns to the mounted officer. The officer points toward a side street. Mangold and Layman dash into the crowd and push past people and their umbrellas. As rain pours down on him, soaking his coat and hair, Layman glimpses Libby amid a sea of umbrellas. He rushes toward her, frantically moving through the crowd. As he reaches a spot congested with people, he slowly squeezes his way through. Leaving one crowd behind, Layman stops and glances around at the throngs of umbrella-carrying revelers. Mangold catches up, and they both scan the crowd. Layman spots the red umbrella and runs down a narrow side street after it. Keeping his gaze on the red umbrella, Layman bumps into people as he follows it. As the pursued woman slips between other pedestrians, Layman grabs her arm and swings her around.
Hey!
It's not Libby.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What do you think you're doing?
No, I'm very sorry, ma'am. I thought you were somebody else. It was a case of mistaken identity. Sure. Have a good evening.
I take it that ain't her.
Through a nearby store window, Libby peeks at the two men from behind a mannequin. Mangold walks off. Layman glances at the storefront, then follows. Daytime. At the Maison Beaucoeur, Layman lifts his hand to an open office door.
Mr. Layman.
Nick waves him in.
Come in.
Thank you.
Can I offer you a Cuban cigar?
Oh, no, thanks.
Layman stands at Nick's desk.
Well, as you can see...
Nick gets a cigar.
I'm
I'm alive and kicking.
Yeah.
So what can I do for you this morning?
We spotted the Parsons woman in the quarter last night. She got away. I just came out to find out if you'd heard from her.
Nick shakes his head.
Not a peep.
Do you have any idea why she's fixated her lunacy on you?
Well, the world's full of crazy people, am I right?
Oh, yes, you are right. Truer words were never spoken.
Nick lights the cigar.
Those are nice pictures there.
Two Kandinskys.
Do kids do them?
Nick gapes incredulously.
No. Those pictures are by a very great artist named Kandinsky.
Oh.
But why do I think you already knew that?
Layman stares stone-faced.
Excuse me for a second. Yes.
Nick lowers the phone and gives Layman a polite smile.
This is a business call.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hope you'll excuse me. Now, let yourself out that back door. It leads down to the kitchen. Yeah, get the chef to fix you a fabulous New Orleans breakfast.
Okay.
Layman leaves. Nick watches the door close, then puts the phone to his ear.
Morning, Don. I hope you had a nice night.
At a payphone.
I want you to bring Maddie to Lafayette Cemetery number 3.
A cemetery? That's an odd choice for a reunion.
It's a big tourist place, Nick. A lot of people around.
Well, you're smart, girl. I can have him there by 4.
Libby hangs up. Later, a band leads a funeral procession into Lafayette Cemetery. In front, a large man carries a parasol and wears a red sash that reads, Spirit of New Orleans. Behind the band, a man drives a horse-drawn hearse. A long line of mourners in dark dresses and suits follow the casket through the cemetery gate. Libby stands among a small group of tourists and watches the procession file past. Peering past the mourners, she spots Nick. He cocks his head and lifts his eyebrows. As old men with umbrellas bring up the rear of the procession, Libby hurries around them and faces Nick.
Where's Maddie?
Relax. He was nervous, so I just told him he could go play inside.
Libby walks through the gate behind the mourners, and Nick slowly follows. Libby scans the cemetery.
There he is.
Libby walks in the direction of his gaze.
Maddie! Come over here, son.
A boy with brown hair glances at them.
Oh, Maddie. Okay, I'll get him for you.
No. It's something I want to do.
Libby walks along a row of burial vaults toward the boy.
Maddie?
He glances at Libby, then heads down a path lined with mausoleums. Nick stays put and watches Libby pursue him.
Maddie? Hey, kiddo.
She peers around a tomb and spots him in the distance.
Hey, Maddie!
The boy glances at her, then continues walking. With a confused glance toward Nick, Libby follows the boy down the pathway. He turns a corner between two tombstones. Libby quickens her pace and glances between each mausoleum for a glimpse of her son. Hidden between two rows of tombs, the boy walks quickly and glances over his shoulder. As Libby moves on, peering from side to side, the mourners proceed toward their destination a few rows away. Libby stops and puts her hands on her hips. To her left, she spots the boy sitting on the steps of a mausoleum. He casually sips from a soda bottle. Libby keeps her eyes fixed on him as she approaches. As he looks off, scratching his leg, Libby smiles gently.
Maddie?
He looks at her, then runs away.
Maddie, it's Mommy.
Libby's brow furrows. Nick grabs her from behind. He slams her head against the stone mausoleum. Nick glances about as he lugs her limp body into the unlocked tomb. He drops her on the stone floor beside a coffin draped in cobwebs. Now, Layman types Jonathan Devereaux into Mangold's computer.
You ever arrest anybody you thought was innocent, Mangold?
Layman studies the screen.
Nope.
A blinking window reads, no results found. Layman frowns.
Of course, there's no information on Jonathan Devereaux that's over 3 years old. 3 years ago, the guy didn't exist.
So he changed his name. Lots of folks change their name, Layman. That don't make him a criminal.
Yeah, but I'm betting he changed it from Simon Ryder, and before that it was Nick Parsons.
But you can't prove it.
No.
At Lafayette Cemetery, the funeral party struts to the jazz band's beat, gaily waving their handkerchiefs. Nearby, the brown-haired boy sits on the steps of a mausoleum. Nick approaches and hands him some money. The boy flips through it and takes off. Nick strides off in the opposite direction, buttoning the tailored jacket to his charcoal suit. At the police station, Mangold sees Layman on the office phone.
Hey, is that long distance?
Layman rolls his eyes.
Bill me. Lucy, hi, this is Travis. Listen, I want you to get the DMV to fax me a Washington driver's license photograph of one Nicholas Parsons. I'm at the New Orleans Police Department.
Travis, you better talk to Mr. Carruthers. His colon is twisted in a knot.
Carl grabs the phone.
I've had to cover your office for you, Travis.
Where the hell are you?
Listen to me, Carl. I think maybe this Parsons woman has been telling the truth.
You're not a law professor anymore, Travis.
You're barely even a parole officer. So stop playing Mission Impossible.
The driver's license photograph of Nicholas Parsons.
Now, you get back here today, because tomorrow you're going in front of the commissioner.
Carl, I know I'm right. You give me a chance, okay? Now, I'm asking you politely. You send me that damn picture.
Layman glances around angrily, then hangs up. Now, in the dark, Libby's cigarette lighter flicks on, illuminating her face and folds of fabric surrounding her. Reaching up, she presses against the material that lies inches above her face. Her brow furrowed, Libby turns her head to one side and gapes. She turns her head to her left and runs the lighter along the pleated fabric wall beside her. Moving the lighter toward her feet, she illuminates the rest of the coffin. The soles of her tennis shoes push against one end. The lighter goes out. A spark briefly shoots from the lighter, then disappears. Libby tries again, and a flame ignites. Libby grimaces as she arcs her neck and gazes around. She turns and comes eye to eye with the gray, leathery face of a corpse. The lighter goes out again. Libby ignites it, then pushes against the coffin's lid. Inside the burial vault, sunlight filters through a stained glass window and shines on the dusty wooden coffin. Inside, Libby slides her hand along her leg and feels around. Her tongue sticks out from between her lips as her fingertips reach for her backpack. Inching it closer, she opens it, and her hand searches its contents. She finds Layman's .38 revolver and lays it on her leg. Her face glistening with sweat, she rips loose the seam where the lid and coffin body meet. As she pries apart the draped material with one hand, the other brings the light near, illuminating a hinge. She aims the gun at it and turns her head. The hinge and wood around it shatter. Daylight shines in through the small hole. Libby flicks on the lighter and rips at the seam over a hinge by her waist. A bullet rips through the hinge, and the coffin's thick lid rises a few inches. It falls shut. Libby strains, pushing the lid higher. It crashes to the floor, and Libby scrambles from the box. She slams the palms of her hands against the mausoleum door, then kicks it. Outside, nothing but tombs populate the deserted cemetery. Inside, Libby picks up a vase on the window ledge and throws it through the stained glass. Now, in the police station, Layman watches a copy of Nicholas Parsons' Washington driver's license roll out of a fax machine. The picture shows a man in his 50s.
It's not him.
See, Layman, the thing is, every now and again, we all want to believe in something. But we just keep forgetting that 99.9% of the time, life just flat don't work out.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, Mango. Thanks. I feel a lot better now.
Anytime, Austin. Anytime.
Now, on the street, Libby walks determinedly with her backpack slung over her shoulder. As she crosses in front of a side street, a taxi drives toward her. From the back seat, Layman spots her.
Hold it. Hold it right here.
As Layman gets out, a horse-drawn carriage blocks his view. It passes. Libby is gone. Layman scans the busy sidewalks, then gets back in the taxi. Now a doorman stands under the Maison Beaucourt sign. As Libby nears the hotel, she licks her lips. A hand grabs her and pulls her from the street. Layman faces her.
It's over, Libby.
Her mouth contorts into a grimace. As Libby leans her head against his shoulder, Layman puts his arms around her and gently rests his hand on her head. She clings to him.
I'm Sandra Mitchell. Tonight at 11, showing support to U.S. troops overseas this holiday weekend, it's Operation Gratitude, and a sea lion rescued off the coast of Venice just minutes away at 11.
Pizza Hut would like to remind you, if you don't dip your Dippin' Strips pizza, it will dip you.
She's still got it.
They're back. Dippin' Strips pizza from Pizza Hut with three dips, just $9.99.
I haven't lost my jump shot or my passion. My multivitamin, Centrum Silver.
Centrum Silver has a group of essential nutrients that emerging science suggests may help reduce the risk of heart disease. Put your heart into what you love with age-adjusted Centrum Silver.
It starts with a dream. To act, to sing, to dance.
Then at last, Broadway.
Applause, ovation.
Then the dream of all dreams. A Tony nomination. Winning, well, that's just icing on the cake.
Thank you so much.
Join your favorite stars in live performances you can't see anywhere else. Hugh Jackman hosts
the Tony Awards.
Catch Broadway at its brightest, live CBS next Sunday.
Messages.
The desk clerk hands him a few envelopes.
Thank you.
Glancing at them, he crosses the lobby.
Mr. Devereaux?
Mr. Lehman, I'm sorry. This is really not a good time.
I understand. You know, a lot of people feel that way about me, but I have good news.
Mm-hmm. Nick arches his brows.
Won't take long.
Now, Nick leads Lehman into his office.
Well, turns out I owe you an apology, Mr. Devereaux. After our last conversation, I started thinking, maybe that Parsons woman is telling the truth about who you used to be. So, I asked the Washington State Department of Motor Vehicles to send me a driver's license photograph of Nicholas Parsons.
And
this is what came up.
He takes the fax of the driver's license from his pocket and holds it up, smiling. Nick takes the fax and gives it a closer look.
Well, we all make mistakes. I mean, there's no harm done.
Then I thought about it some more, and it occurred to me what a common name Nicholas Parsons is. You know, it turns out there were six. And this?
He takes out another fax.
It's number three.
The license photo shows Nick. Nick looks disdainfully at Lehman.
I never liked that picture.
Lehman puts down the faxes as Nick takes a seat.
So, Mr. Lehman, you came here to make a deal. Otherwise, I guess you would have gone straight to the police, so...
Lehman nods.
The question is, what's your price?
$1 million.
They both grin.
It's a nice round figure, right?
Nick drops his gaze and shakes his head.
All right. But you're going to have to give me a couple of days.
No way, $1 million right now.
Nick stands.
Mr. Lehman, it's 9 o'clock at night. I can't just...
Nick watches Lehman take out a cell phone.
Wait a minute. Wait.
Ready to dial, Lehman looks up.
I have $100,000 in the safe here. And you can have that now.
Nick looks him in the eye.
I'll get you the rest tomorrow.
You got a deal.
Lehman folds up his phone.
We do have one other problem, and that's Mrs. Parsons. She can still make a lot of trouble for us, even from prison, and I really don't need that.
Well, I think I've solved that problem.
What do you mean?
Let's just say the problem has been buried.
Really?
She's gone, I promise you.
The two men gaze at each other, then Nick's eyes shift to the door. Lehman smiles. Libby steps inside, closes the door, and takes the gun from her waistband.
You're not very good at keeping promises, Nick.
Nick backs away from her.
You gonna do something?
What are you talking to me for? She's the one with the gun.
Libby backs Nick across the room.
They're tough in Louisiana, Libby. You shoot me, they'll give you the gas chamber.
No, they won't. It's called double jeopardy. I learned a few things in prison, Nick. I could shoot you in the middle of Mardi Gras and they can't touch me.
As an ex-law professor, I can assure you she is right.
Libby's eyes fill with tears as she points the gun at Nick.
Where's my son?
Nick glares.
In St. Albans School in Georgia, all right? You have your son back. You got what you want.
The bullet shatters the framed Kandinsky behind Nick. Lehman shifts in his seat. Libby grins, stifling a laugh.
I haven't felt that good in 6 years.
Nick takes a seat at his desk.
I don't want to kill you, Nick. I just want you to suffer like I suffered.
What she means, Nick, is you're going to prison. For murder.
Who did I supposedly murder?
Me.
Lehman holds a tape recorder.
Well, I think I've solved that problem.
What do you mean?
Let's just say the problem has been buried.
Really?
She's gone, I promise you.
He pockets the recorder.
Taped confessions are very persuasive in court, Nick. And, of course, there is the physical evidence that we're going to put in the trunk of your car.
A shovel, hair, my fingerprints, a little blood.
Don't forget the gasoline.
It'll look like you burned and buried my body, just like you say on the tape.
Nick swallows.
The prosecution rests.
Lehman faces Libby.
You better get out of here. Nobody wants a dead woman walking around when the police are trying to arrest a guy for her murder.
As Libby turns, Nick grabs a gun.
Wait a minute. I'll
I'll take that gun.
As Layman steps in front of Libby, Nick fires, hitting him in the shoulder. Libby drops her gun and dives behind the sofa. As she squirms on the floor, bullets rip through the sofa back. Nick eyes Layman, who lies slumped in a corner. As Libby sits up, Nick heads around the sofa toward her. Trembling, Libby stares up at Nick. As Nick raises the gun, Layman tackles him. They crash into a small table and send a large floral arrangement to the ground. As Libby gets to her feet and dashes away, the men struggle for control of Nick's gun. Nick kneels over Layman and tries to free the gun from his hand. Layman shoves his palm against Nick's face. Nick punches the bullet hole in Layman's shoulder. As Layman grimaces, sprawled on the floor, Nick stands and aims the gun at him. A bullet rips through Nick's chest. Nick stares vacantly. As he slumps to the floor, a shattered mirror shows Libby holding Layman's gun. Layman looks up at her, then relaxes his head to the floor. With her eyes fixed on Nick, Libby lowers the gun and shakes her head. Later, as police cars block off the street, paramedics wheel Layman's gurney from the Maison Beaucoeur. Libby walks alongside him. Mangold approaches.
Well, Layman, you gonna live?
Layman shakes his head.
I doubt it.
Ms. Parsons, since you are still legally his wife, I expect you just inherited yourself a right fine little hotel here.
Not interested.
Layman grimaces as a paramedic dabs his wound with gauze.
I guess I'm gonna take off now.
No. No, you're not. You're a parole violator. You're in my custody. You're going with me to Seattle, where I will demand a full pardon. And a parade. And a little pink poodle.
He lifts his hand.
On a keychain.
Libby smiles gratefully. Daytime. A sign reads, St. Albans School. A blue sedan drives past the sign down a residential street and parks alongside a schoolyard where boys play soccer. Libby sits in the driver's seat. Layman sits beside her, his arm in a sling. Libby peers through the car windows and scans the field. Layman faces her.
What are you waiting for?
She sits motionless.
Go on.
Libby shifts her gaze to Layman.
I don't know if I've ever been so scared in my whole life.
Layman smiles.
I think a big part of me never thought I'd really find him.
Libby gazes wistfully at the schoolyard.
What if he doesn't recognize me? I mean, maybe after all...
Damn, woman. Because of you, I have lost a perfectly good used car and a not-so-good job. If you don't go to this kid right now, I'm going to have you arrested. For stupidity. Go on.
Libby stares ahead, takes a deep breath, and unfastens her seatbelt.
Thanks, Layman. You saved my life.
Layman drops his gaze as Libby opens the door and steps out.
You saved mine, too.
Now, Libby crosses the grass alongside the field. As the soccer ball gets kicked between the two teams, Libby peers at the 10-year-old players. She lifts her hand to shield her eyes from the sun. The coach approaches her.
Coach Matthews, how are you doing?
Nice to meet you.
It'll be halftime soon.
Libby's focus remains fixed on the boys. Her gaze settles on a thin boy with shaggy brown hair and freckles. The boy races between his teammates, his alert eyes on the ball. As she gazes at the boy, Layman gets out of the car.
Maddie.
The boy faces her.
Maddie.
Libby gives him an encouraging nod. Maddie's brow furrows as he steps toward her. She smiles and the boy quickens his pace, his questioning eyes fixed on her.
Hi.
Libby stoops, resting her hands on her knees. Maddie looks her in the eye.
Do you know who I am?
Maddie smiles and nods.
They told me you were dead.
Libby lets out a breathy laugh.
No, sweetheart.
Libby's eyes brim with tears. As Maddie gazes at her, Libby reaches out and caresses his cheek. Maddie puts his hand to hers. She grins broadly at him. Outside the car, Layman watches and smiles to himself. Libby hesitantly reaches for Maddie and wraps her arms around him. Closing his eyes and smiling serenely, Maddie holds his mother tight. A tear rolls down his cheek as he rests his head on his mother's shoulder. Libby smiles and opens her eyes. As she starts to let him go, Maddie continues to cling to her. She grins over his shoulder and holds him close. Fade to black.